How do you cook a prairie chicken in 1877? The first step is to cut out all the shot. Then you gotta clean that bird with baking soda and sew it back up with the cotton thread. I learned that while reading a book on the food Mark Twain dreamed of while homesick in Europe. There's a tendency today to think of Europe's culinary traditions as superior to our own, but Mark Twain, who dined on prairie chickens and porterhouse steaks, peach cobbler, and Saratoga potatoes, found German food, and I quote, insipid. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and I'd like to welcome Andrew Beers to the show. He's the author of Twain's Feast, Searching for America's Lost Foods in the Footsteps of Samuel Clemens, which has recently inspired a new podcast with comedian Nick Offerman. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Gina. Thanks so much for having me.
It is super funny to me how Mark Twain uses the word insipid to describe European food.
I know, it's really not what you expect. But, you know, when he was traveling around Europe in 1878 and 9, he was with his family. And so most of the time, he found himself limited to eating in hotels, which you kind of think about yourself being if you could only eat in airports. It was really second tier, kind of drab, dry food. And so that's what he got real sick of it after traveling around for about 18 months.
Yeah, you list these German phrases he wants to master, and they're all just different ways to insult food, like this tea isn't good, this coffee isn't good, this bread seems old. Isn't there a curious smell about? And isn't that something in the butter?
Yeah, he decided to start learning those phrases very, very early on. He knew that he was in bad shape for this trip.
But what fascinates me about that is it turns out that a lot of the accepted wisdom about who makes real food and who's got the fake stuff, it turns that on its head when you think about how we tend to think of European food versus American food. I mean, he calls it like imposter food in Europe.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing is, Twain knew America really, really well. He was one of the great travelers of his day. And so when he sits down towards the end of this trip in Europe, in Vienna, to write kind of a fantasy menu, you know, you can feel him drawing on his travels and going into the depths that American food had to offer at the time. So, you know, he starts off saying, like, look, I want this. I'm done with European food. I want this meal ready for me when I get off the steamer home in 6 months, you know, a small private affair all to myself. But he riffs for like 85, 100 items, something like that, depending on how you count. And yeah, I mean, it's spectacular. I mean, it's radishes, frogs, baked apples, porterhouse steak, roast turkey, cranberries, all sorts of American pastry, he says.
You know what? Can I pause at baked apples? Because you know what? I grew up eating baked apples, but I have not known a lot of other people who are like, you know what says America in the wintertime to me? Baked apples.
Yeah. He's a lot of these foods came from his memories of growing up on his uncle's farm. And so you can kind of look back to his days in Missouri and, you know, see what the things were that kind of lodged in his memory. And I think baked apples was among that.
Well, let's back up. I mean, so Mark Twain was living abroad, as you've said. He wrote A Tramp Abroad, which is like a travel memoir. And there is this part, as you've said, where he's imagining a perfect American feast in this very classic homesick traveler kind of way. He makes this long list of foods he's dying to eat. So here you are, though, a guy living in California in the 21st century. You read this and think, I'm going to use this list to make a Mark Twain-inspired breakfast.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the thing is, the breakfast that he describes that, you know, he says when he's in Europe, he's eating a dry piece of bread and maybe some imposter butter because it hasn't been properly salted and all that kind of thing.
The continental breakfast.
Exactly. And then he says the perfect American breakfast is you have to imagine an angel sweeping down out of a better land and setting down before you a porterhouse steak with a perfect gravy and with biscuits and with buttermilk cakes with real maple syrup and with a perfect cup of American coffee with the cream of froth on top. And so, yeah, to start off, I tried to reproduce that as well as I could. And I see where he was coming from. It was pretty good.
So, okay, let's talk about the different elements. I know this was a long time ago now for you, this breakfast, but it left an impression on me, and I think it really sets up why you were so inspired that you kept going with recreating these items from this list. So let's start with the steak itself. I mean, you spent like a week at least, just hunting down the right ingredients for your breakfast. And the steak was supposed to be, what, an inch and a half thick?
Exactly. An inch and a half thick porterhouse. And, you know, I didn't want to just go out and get any steak. I wanted to reproduce the flavors that he had as closely as possible. And so to do that, you know, now most of our beef is corn-fed. And that's got a particular flavor. It's got a particular finishing. But for him, it almost would have certainly been grass-fed, maybe corn-finished. But it would have eaten grass through its whole life. And then also it would have been dry-aged instead of wet-aged. We've changed the whole aging process where, you know, it's faster. You have to use less the storage facilities for less time. So anything that's quicker, that equals money in the preparation process for a steak. So I wanted to find something that was grass-fed, dry-aged, an inch and a half thick. You know, they're out there, but you sometimes have to do some work trying to track this stuff down.
So you get that steak, and then you've got to make some biscuits. Anything to share about the biscuits?
You know, not really on the biscuits, I don't think. I used a recipe that was given to me when I used to be in archaeology, and I was working on a plantation in Virginia. And so that just felt like on that, I was more trying to draw on the idea that Twain had drawn on his own memories, you know, kind of tastes that he recalled from his own life. And so I was trying to kind of reproduce that feeling more than the actual flavor.
Okay, so then the pieces of the breakfast beyond the steak that really were intriguing to me, the coffee and cream, which go together, of course. But if you travel with Americans in Europe, a lot, the difference between American coffee and European coffee is usually observed still today. However, again, usually the American coffee is what gets the snub. And like you hear about like, oh, this real full fat cream of Europe. But Mark Twain has the opposite issue.
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, he saw that in hotels, they were mostly watering the coffee down. And he referred to the cream as being baptized because there was so much water in it. Like you'd pour water over the cream. So it was just, again, it was trying to keep things very cheap and kind of efficient. You're just feeding travelers. And he recalled, you know, some of the great coffee that he'd had in New York or maybe Chicago, his travels around the country, San Francisco, certainly, and especially the cream. That was the thing that was maybe a little bit trickier to track down because his cream would have been always and forever raw. So it hadn't been pasteurized, and so it didn't have this kind of like just slightly burnt flavor that isn't detectable to our tastes anymore, really. We're so used to it. And that's kind of what we think milk should taste like. But if you have raw cream, it's got a sweetness and a richness and kind of a forward flavor to it.
You tracked this down, but raw cream is not legal to sell in all states. And then when it is legal, it's expensive and it's like a delicacy. Can you tell me about was this the first raw cream you had tasted?
It was definitely. And you're right. I think it's illegal in 37 states. I'm forgetting the exact number.
But you can't
get it everywhere. And fortunately, I live close to a market that actually carries it. But it's, you know, it's $15 for half a pint or something. It's incredibly expensive.
Worth it?
Once or twice. I don't stock my refrigerator with it, but it was definitely worth it that day.
And then the syrup is you cheated because you disagreed with Mark Twain's assessment of what makes a good American syrup.
Well, I went with dark maple syrup, right? And he says he wants clear maple syrup. And I really love the richness of a darker maple syrup. You know, there's kind of all different levels of flair where maybe it tastes a little bit floral. Maybe there's a buttery taste to it. And he said clear. But then this is something where in following Twain, you'd realize that sometimes there was a reason behind what he said. So for him, when you used to make syrup out of doors with, you know, fires going and ashes and cinders and all that kind of thing, saying clear maple syrup for him, I think might have just meant clean, you know, transparent, like it was done well and you didn't have this kind of like sooty, ashy insertion to it. And so looking back on it, I actually think that maybe I was more in line with what he wanted.
Okay, so I just want to say this is not your first cooking project inspired by literature. And that is curious to me. When you're reading along, any mention of food seems to stop you in your tracks. What do you think is going on there?
That's a good question. And I don't I don't know that I have a great answer for that. It's just always been true. I was an incredibly picky eater as a kid. And I think that the way that I got into being a more exploratory reader was eater was through reading. You know, kind of reading people eating about exotic things or enjoying great meals kind of got me excited about trying things in the way that maybe like a travelogue would get you excited about going to visit a different place.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like, I mean, I don't know you, we have not met, but it does seem from reading this book, like your brain is just wired in this way that puts food in the same place as literature. Like they live in the same part of your imagination.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that's true. I mean, they're both ways that of kind of marking out your life. I mean, I think that all of us, if we're lucky enough, have recollections of a particular book that might have changed our life or kind of helped us to think about the world in a different way. And that often is very situated for people. Like, oh yeah, I read that this one summer where I was at home or I was on vacation or something like that. And I think food occupies some of the same place. You know, where these are things that you experience and then kind of carry the memory of, and they help to mark out the way you see things from then on.
Okay, so you make this breakfast. It's got steak and biscuits and coffee and frothy cream and maple syrup. And you'd think that that would have satisfied your personal need to make Mark Twain's favorite foods, but it did not. It became this long-term obsession, which then launched you next step onto a trip to Illinois to observe prairie chickens at like sunrise or something crazy like that. And there is a lot to find strange about that life choice on your part. But I am going to focus on the fact that you went to Illinois, not Missouri. Mark Twain ate prairie chicken as a child in Missouri.
Well, he did, but he specified on his menu prairie hens from Illinois. And that was actually the thing that really helped the book kind of come together for me and help me realize what it was I was looking at. Because, you know, like you said, I'm reading this stuff and I tend to just stop short. And so I have this whole long menu of Mark Twain's. And I was thinking, okay, well, you know, maybe a cookbook. It'll be – I'll have a little recipe from a period – from, you know, historical recipes and say kind of, well, this is how it would have been cooked, a little introductory couple lines. But then prairie hens from Illinois, I mean – okay, if you're from that area, maybe you've grown up knowing about prairie hens, but I'd never even heard of one. And so I'm kind of like, okay, what's
a
prairie
hen? You're from the East Coast, right?
I'm from the East Coast. I'm from Connecticut and live in California now. And so I'm going, what's a prairie hen and why do they have to be from Illinois? And looking into it, I realized that when Mark Twain was a kid, there were like three or four times as many prairie hens in Illinois right across the river from Hannibal. As ever before or ever since. There were like 14 million prairie hens in Illinois. They were everywhere and they were huge and fat. And the reason was that John Deere invented the plow that could effectively break the prairie just 2 years after Twain was born. So, you know, before Twain was born, it's like you just have kind of unbroken prairie in Illinois. And then right during his youth, people are coming in with these relatively inexpensive plows and making this checkerboard of corn and grass. So the prairie hens still have habitat. They still have wild grassland. But they also have this incredible food source. They've got corn everywhere. And so there's tons of these birds. And I think that was just so dramatic for him. I mean, if you've heard prairie hens in the morning when they're booming at dawn using their throat sacs, they can be heard for miles. And so I kind of like to think of him hearing that from across the river where there would have been more grasslands running right up to the Mississippi.
That is something that you heard on this trip you took.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's this deep ululation. You know, you can go out to Prairie Ridge National Wildlife Area and listen to it. And to me, I mean, it just sounded so exotic and bizarre. I mean, one of the people I was with in the blind said, this doesn't even sound like America. And I know what she was saying. But that was such a striking
But it would if
way
you lived in Illinois,
probably. Exactly, exactly. I mean, back then, it wouldn't have just – it would have been the inescapable sound of that part of America. There would have been no way to get away from it. Now you have to travel to hear that and to experience that.
There's a passage about the native foods of Missouri that I'd really like you to read. And I want to clarify, this is Mark Twain's writing about the native foods of Missouri. He's remembering the foods of his childhood, and you observe – that it's like a song or a prayer or something, the way it's written.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So this is from when he was growing up in Hannibal. He would go out to his Uncle John Quarles' prairie farm in Florida, Missouri, which was situated right between the prairie and the forest. And so, yeah, here it is. I can call back the prairie and its loneliness and peace, and a vast hawk hanging motionless in the sky, with his wings spread wide and the blue of the vault showing through the fringe of their end feathers. I can see the blue clusters of wild grapes hanging among the foliage of the saplings, and I remember the taste of them and the smell. I know how the wild blackberries looked and how they tasted, and the same with the pawpaws, the hazelnuts, and the persimmons. And I can feel the thumping rain upon my head of hickory nuts and walnuts when we were out in the frosty dawn to scramble for them with the pigs. I know the taste of maple sap and when to gather it. I know how a prize watermelon looks when it is sunning its fat rotundity among pumpkin vines and cymbelins. I know the look of green apples and peaches and pears on the trees, and I know how entertaining they are when they are in sight of a person. I know how ripe ones look when they are piled in pyramids under the trees, and how pretty they are, and how vivid the colors. I know the look of an apple that is roasting and sizzling on a hearth on a winter's evening, and I know the comfort that comes of eating it hot, along with some sugar and a drench of cream.
Andrew Beers, now that you have written this book about food in Mark Twain's America, Twain's Feast, where you researched his favorite foods and recreated several of the dishes like as faithfully as possible, is there something that you think you understand about the food of the prairie or the food of Missouri that even those of us who live here today may not know or get?
You know, the thing that came across no matter where I was is just how rooted in place food used to be. So that was certainly true for Missouri as much as anywhere in the world where you're talking about prairie hens. And then also just, you know, you feel from that passage that I just read how much it wasn't just a meal that he would eat. It was a place that he experienced through food. And so that really became a reality for me through this while I was following Twain. So it's, you know, the deep rootedness of prairie hens in Missouri, of oysters in San Francisco Bay, of terrapin in Maryland. These were important to Twain, and, you know, I think he also didn't see how quickly they could disappear.
Well, call 816-235-2888 if you have a story about recreating an heirloom recipe that captures a piece of America's past, or if you've ever tried to recreate a recipe from something in literature. What happened? What did you learn? 816-235-2888. This is KCUR's Central Standard. We'll be right back. We are back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and I'm here with Andrew Beers. He's written a book about food in Mark Twain's America. It started with his discovery of a passage in one of Twain's memoirs where he's homesick in Europe and getting really, really, really sick of European food. So he is dreaming of his favorite American meals, and he just lists everything he wants to eat. Our guest recreated several of those dishes as faithfully as possible, which was difficult because in a lot of cases, the ingredients themselves had changed or disappeared. And you were kind of getting at that, right, Andrew?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you can't just go out and, prepare a Baltimore terrapin anymore. You know, these kinds of turtles, they've been hunted out. They're gone. So in a lot of cases, I couldn't even attempt to recook these things. But when I could, I tried to source it as closely as I could and, you know, enjoy the same flavors that Twain did.
Having nothing to do with food per se, I find it really endearing that Mark Twain was so painfully homesick. I really think of him as this, like, tough guy. And there is something so vulnerable and sentimental about being homesick.
Yeah, you know, that's so true. And, you know, I grew up in Connecticut, and so I kind of grew up knowing that he had spent a lot of his years in Hartford, which I think is probably less known than his Missouri connection. But a lot of people think that the happiest years of his life, or some among them certainly, were the 10 years that he spent with his family in Hartford as a family man. He had this wonderful home, and the meals there were kind of known far and wide for being kind of these wonderful, homey, but at the same time elegant meals. And he loved celebrating with friends and family and eating. And I think he just couldn't wait to get back to the U.S.
Have you ever experienced homesickness as a craving for a particular food?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, this, I've been thinking about this a lot recently because, I mean, I'm in Northern California, and so I used to abalone dive. It's this kind of giant snail that you can go out and you dive for, and you get this one. It's just this spectacular kind of like rich, buttery flavor. And just in the last couple of years, those have completely disappeared. Like they're just gone. And so that's been really bringing me back to Twain and kind of thinking like, oh, well, did he see these things go? I mean, a lot of these foods were disappearing during his lifetime. I'm not sure how much he actually understood that or saw it in the moment. But I sure understand how like losing a food like that can be a blow.
You can join this conversation at 816-235-2888. Andrew Beers, let's get back to some of the foods from Twain's, like, nostalgic catalog. We focused earlier on foods he ate in Missouri and on the prairie, but part of what Mark Twain's list reveals is how well-traveled he was within the states. There are regional delicacies from everywhere.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he loved New Orleans. You know, he'd gone up and down the Mississippi as a riverboat pilot for years. I mean, there's foods from Connecticut where he raised his family, certainly from Missouri, San Francisco and Lake Tahoe, where he went as a young reporter and kind of discovered his writer's voice. I mean, you can really track his biography through the foods that he loved. I mean, Philadelphia, where he worked as a printer's apprentice, everywhere.
Tell us about trout at Lake Tahoe.
Trout at Lake Tahoe is one of those things where you kind of think that you can reproduce the flavor and then you realize, oh, yeah, no, you really can't. Like, so trout at Lake Tahoe, there are still trout in the lake. You can go up, you can fish for them and cook them up, and you can cook them the way he would have eaten it. But when Twain was a young man at Lake Tahoe, the trout were these Lahontan cutthroat trout that could have weighed as much as, I think the record is 31 pounds. I mean, a 31-pound trout is just unimaginable. That's like an ocean-going salmon or something. You know, now if you catch a 5-pound trout, it'd be something to write home about. But that's what Twain experienced. He could see these trout through this clear water 100 feet down below his boat. And now those just aren't accessible. But there are efforts being made to bring them back. The Paiute Nation at Pyramid Lake are working on trying to restore some of those old trout because they were very important to the Native Americans in the area. And so there's a really serious effort being made to bring back those fish and thus that flavor.
And can you talk a bit about, I mean, even just the name of this chapter is like, what? Sheephead and croakers.
Right, sheephead. Yeah, that throws everybody a little bit. So sheephead and croakers were two of Twain's favorite fish from New Orleans. And that's an example of where you can see where he was and what he loved to eat, but also kind of what his position was in life. Because sheephead and croakers would have both been relatively inexpensive fish. You know, he's not necessarily talking about softshell crab or shrimp that would have been a whole lot of money. He's talking about something that he could have eaten in a more humble way. So sheep's head is a very bony fish that is absolutely horrifying to look at. I mean, if you've ever seen this thing, they've got a mouth of like three rows of human molars in them. I mean, it's just these horrific teeth. Because they use them to crush up crab. I mean, they're bottom feeders and they eat crab and other shellfish.
And they don't brush.
They don't brush.
They
don't
brush.
There's no flossing.
They don't brush.
Exactly.
Ew.
But the good news is that gives their meat a really nice flavor of like crab and other shellfish. And so it's relatively cheap and inexpensive, but it can be prepared just wonderfully well. And so, yeah, I think that's what he was enjoying there. And then croaker, another small fish that he probably would have eaten just fried by the dozen on a platter. Kind of think of a golden fried crunchy fish. But again, very bony, like not that expensive. So it's something you'd sit down with friends at a meal to a big platter and kind of enjoy that with beer or wine. And
yeah, the beer and wine. I mean, you're in New Orleans and I would think like with today's craft cocktail obsession, you might have learned something from what he drank alongside his sheep's head and croakers.
He definitely – champagne was a big thing back then. And definitely beer. I know that when he went back to New Orleans in 1885, he was amazed to see that there was an ice factory. That was a big thing for him. He was talking about, you know, the Arctic being relocated to New Orleans, which also tells me that in terms of craft cocktails and everything, when he was a younger man in New Orleans, it probably wasn't, the drinks probably weren't as cold as you might have hoped for.
You know, that does remind me that wasn't there like a lot of like fantasizing about cold, cold water in America?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, ice water. He specifically, like, I know it's funny. It's like he said that it's like proper ice water in America. It should be like so cold it hurts your teeth. And then in Europe, you'd get this one little kind of semi-dirty piece of ice in the corner of the glass, and it was tepid and tasteless. I mean, he really got into the weeds on this stuff. He cared about the details.
And so, yeah, there's a lot of fish in this book, FYI, but like. So Mark Twain ate a lot of oysters and mussels in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And was he working at a newspaper in San Francisco? Is that right?
He was. That's really when he kind of broke out as a writer. You know, his first really famous piece that was published coast to coast was the celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, which is in California's Sierra Mountains. And so, you know, that was, he was almost taking like a trip outside of San Francisco. But when he was in San Francisco, he referred to the city as heaven on the half shell because of the feasts of oysters that you would have there. But like many of these other foods, they were just very, very different for him. I mean, now we sit down to these kind of big, sweet Kuramoto or Eastern oysters. The Olympia oysters that Twain knew in San Francisco, you have to think about them more as like the size of a bottle cap. You know, you can eat – he has these passages where he'd talk about eating – 100 oysters, 200 oysters, and you think, my God, how is it possible? But you might have been able to make an omelet with 100 oysters back then. They were tiny and really coppery. And so it was kind of the way you'd spend a whole long evening with friends is you have your champagne and you have your tiny coppery oysters, and you're going to spend a lot of time shucking them.
That sounds really fun. Am I romanticizing the situation?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it sounds great to me. You know, I mean, what's better than just kind of sitting around and drinking and joking and laughing over oysters, right?
So you have recreated a lot of things that Mark Twain would have eaten that he writes about in his book, like to the best of your ability. And I'm curious whether anyone has ever told you that this is kind of like Julie and Julia for dudes with facial hair in the farm to market scene.
Yeah, you know, the books came out almost simultaneously, and I kind of thought, oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I definitely understand the appeal of Julie and Julia, right? I mean, you're going back and you've got these kind of like culinary role models and being able to kind of learn from them. It's great.
What has it been like to turn this project into a podcast with a comedian, Nick Offerman, as a collaborator?
Oh, it was so great. It was so much fun. I mean, you know, Nick has done the audiobooks for Tom Sawyer and for Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. And so he's a big Twain fan from going way back.
Yeah, he calls himself a Twainiac, which is not a thing I'd heard before.
Yeah. He just loves Mark Twain. And so when we sat down with him and started talking to him about this, it was just, you could just feel his enthusiasm and kind of his interest right from the beginning. He just brought so much to it, you know, following his questions and his interests, and also having people go out and revisit these sites 10 years later. I mean, a lot of the book has to do with change, right? Like change to the land, change to the American diet, all sorts of transformation. And so, you know, you could see how things have even just changed in the last 10 years. You know, I mean, when I wrote the book, there were a lot more oysters in the bay, and now there's kind of like, there was a big flush of fresh water, so there's fewer. But anyway, it was just amazing looking at it through working on it with Nick. He's done a lot of writing.
I mean, do you
on
think
American
that the
history himself.
Has, do you think the change has accelerated, or is it just that you're paying attention to it in that more micro kind of way?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think a lot of these big changes happened quite some time ago. I mean, if you want to talk about like prairie hens. You know, I mentioned before, there were 14 million when Twain was growing up in Illinois. Now there's 300 and they have to bring those in from Missouri or from Minnesota. So, I mean, that's been kind of locked in for a long time, but yes, I do think that with things like the oysters, climate change and ocean acidification, I do think things are happening faster, unfortunately.
You know, I mentioned that I was curious about whether any of our listeners had attempted to make a recipe from literature. And the only tip I've gotten along those lines is from my producer, Melody Rowell, who sends me this note. She says that she tried to make a dish for a school project when they read A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, and she said it was disgusting, and she's not clear whether she messed up or if it was just gross. And I've tried to gather more information about this dish. She said she remembers it involving old bread and a lot of eggs and that it was baked, and she found the passage. Thanks, Google. She says, so this is the passage from the book. She'd take a loaf of stale bread, pour boiling water over it, work it up into a paste, flavor it with salt, pepper, thyme, minced onion, and an egg, if eggs were cheap, and bake it in the oven. When it was good and brown, she made a sauce from half a cup of ketchup, 2 cups of boiling water, seasoning, a dash of strong coffee, thickened it with flour, and poured it over the baked stuff. That sounds gross.
It sounds gross. It sounds gross. I mean, what that says to me is like that sounds like a stretching recipe to me, like stuff that you might have, like you've got some stale bread and like maybe you have to buy a more expensive egg, but then like, you know, they're watering down the ketchup with water is what I think I heard you say.
Yeah.
and, you know, so that sounds to me like they're trying to make a little go a long way. And that's a lot of times how food develops, right? Like you have something that you have, it's a necessity, and then you make something great out of it. And maybe something great didn't result from what we're hearing there, but that's still the way it happens a lot. I mean, that was one thing in, you know, Twain wanted raccoon and possum. And I can say, having eaten raccoon, you know, that's not something I'm going back for a lot. Tastes do change, so.
Yeah, and that is something that you tried for the podcast.
Yes. Well, I tried it for the book originally and then for the podcast as well. Yeah.
Because if you're going to eat raccoon, go with a comedian, right?
Definitely. Definitely.
But back to this thing about recipes from literature, you do kind of have this really jam-packed paragraph of other literary cooking experiments you've conducted. And are there any that jump out that are not Twainian that you'd be willing to share that were sort of like taught you something along the lines of what you just learned hearing this this recipe for eggs and stuff?
What I think of is when I was a kid, I had a book that was the Little House on the Prairie cookbook, kind of the Laura Ingalls Wilder cookbook. And that was great. I mean, that I would definitely point listeners to that. It was just kind of this fantastic experience of you know, eating American foods across that part of the country.
Did you try churning your own butter?
We have churned our own butter, but we don't actually have it. We don't churn it. But what my kids love to do is just take heavy, heavy cream, put it into a jar, and just shake the heck out of it for about 10 minutes, and you've got great fresh butter. Add a pinch of salt and a couple of fresh herbs like thyme or sage or something like that, and it's wonderful.
So that goes in the official recipe, shake the heck out of it?
Definitely. Sure.
Back to Twain, before we say goodbye, one of the intriguing tidbits here is that in this list of foods that he's fantasizing about in A Tramp Abroad, the list begins with radishes.
Right. I know. Twain always goes with something unexpected, right? So it's like the list is so full of like these rich, kind of unctuous, you know, buttery flavors, stuff that you kind of imagine having to go to sleep after. But he starts with this clean, crisp, kind of slightly peppery flavor. I mean, I love that about him, that he had an ability to appreciate things that were good in their own terms, right?
Yeah, he had also, you know, tomatoes just...
Right. Tomatoes dressed with vinegar, I think, and salt, or, you know, there was, you know, new rose potatoes roasted on the hearth. Sometimes it's like he almost runs away with himself where he just says, you know, all sorts of southern breads or all sorts of pastries. You know, you can tell that there's this whole kind of litany or menagerie of breads or pastries that he'd love to get into if only he had time.
With the radishes, I love this observation you have that clearly he isn't listing these foods. He starts with radishes, so he doesn't just happen to be super hungry that day.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it feels more like a meditation to me, where he's just running through these things. It's not like you're exactly right. I mean, if he was just hungry, roast turkey is first, or porterhouse steak, or, you know, something like that. But radishes, it's like he's in a more contemplative mood. He's sitting back and remembering these places and these flavors that he's enjoyed through his life and seeing where they take him.
Okay, so let's end this conversation with cranberries. Talk to me about cranberries.
Oh, cranberries. Yeah, you know, one of the things that that I tried to do was focus on wild foods, because those were a lot of the things that were very rooted in place for Twain. And cranberries, I found, had just been cultivated for the first time when Twain was in Twain's day. You know, they were basically a wild berry that people just figured out, hey, if you dump sand over them, they grow more strongly. It's kind of like a natural mulch or a natural pruning. And so they were kind of just entering the American diet as like a core Thanksgiving meal.
Can I just say, I'm really relieved that although it sounds like a lot of foods are disappearing, like it sounds like cranberries are more bountiful.
Yeah, cranberries are doing great.
Cranberries made a comeback.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Cranberries do, maple syrup. I mean, it's one thing that you really see here is that when people decide they want to care for something or bring it out, it's, you know, they can do it. Cranberries are doing great. There's still bogs all over Massachusetts, New Jersey, Wisconsin, but they've really become, you know, a part of the American calendar. They're one of those truly seasonal foods for us. And it's just great to be able to share that kind of thing.
Andrew Beers, author of Twain's Feast, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Twain's Feast came out in 2011, but Andrew has turned this project into a podcast with Nick Offerman. Be sure to check that out for more adventures in dining, Mark Twain style, like Raccoon. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up next, the local photographer who's part of a big show on the last 100 years of great American portraits. Not too shabby. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and my next guest is photographer Nick Vidros. He's one of only 10 living photographers included in the Portraits Americana show at the Albrecht Kemper Museum in St. Joe. It's a show that captures great portraits from the last 100 years of American photography, so being included is a big deal. Nick Vidros, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
What was it like to walk through the exhibit Portraits Americana and see your work being presented as like iconic great American photography?
It was a little overwhelming. I felt very fortunate to be picked. And you're correct, it was one of 10 living photographers, but unfortunately, as of Friday, now it's down to 9.
I'm so sorry to hear that.
Mark Hauser passed away over the weekend, and he was one of the great living portrait photographers.
Tell me a little more about him.
Mark and I had been friends since 1981, and I just always loved his work and admired him. And a little bit of Mark came into my DNA just through the appreciation that I had for how he did things. And we stayed in touch, and I visited him in Chicago numerous times. And quite a legend has passed on.
Well, I'm really sorry to hear that. You have two pictures in this show. One is of George Brett, and you took that in 1983. Tell me about that photo.
The George Brett photo came about. I had been working on some commercial work with George for TWA, for Lifebuoy, and I always noticed that George was squeaky clean. And
in his appearance?
In his appearance, yeah. His uniform was perfectly pressed, and he just didn't seem quite like a real baseball player.
A model of a baseball player or something.
Exactly. So what I did was I remember him after a game that he was hot and sweaty, and I remember seeing him close up, and I said, George, you need to come down to the studio and let's do a great shot of you, similar to one I saw of Lou Gehrig one time it was more real. And he was game. He came down to the studio. And
so you just right then and there said, the way you look right now, we need to do this.
No. He came in squeaky clean.
Oh.
And I took him down into the basement of my fire station, which was always dusty and dirty. And I had him rattle off 30, 40, 50 push-ups.
So you invite George Brett over and you make him like drop and give you 50 or whatever?
George drop and give me 50. And I had a stylist with me, and we worked him up to that. I mean, we worked him into perspiration like it was just exactly right after a game. And the realism of that permeated the photograph. And I have to be honest with you. I did some with George's shirt off. I did some with a bat. I did. My brain was not fully baked at that age in my career. I didn't have a complete vision of what I wanted to do.
How old were you?
Let's see. Probably in my early 30s. Yeah, maybe around 32. That doesn't matter as much, but I was always looking for the photograph, and later on, I would envision the photograph in my mind, and then I would start to head toward that, and then still maintaining what I called mental agility for when something happened or they did something that was authentic to them, then I'd be prepared to shoot.
But you needed that practice to start being able to envision it.
Oh, yeah, the practice is essential. It's that 10,000 hours that you hear about every profession.
But so you're there with George Brett, and you have him recreate his, like, post-game sweat. And you dropped this little detail in your firehouse. Tell me about your firehouse.
Yeah, I bought the old fire station number 3 at 19th and Central in 1982, I believe. And it was a huge building. And I was really one of the founders in the Crossroads district. I'd moved down to the Crossroads in 1977. But I'm not the godfather of the Crossroads. They call Jim Leedy the godfather, but actually it's Nate Accardo.
Well, that is probably another story to tell. But so you are with George Brett and you recreate this sweat. But like at this stage in your life, is it funny to you that a photograph you took when you were, as you put it, like still figuring it out, that you hadn't fully baked your ideas of photography? This photo lives in this survey of American photography, portrait photography for the last 100 years.
Yeah, sometimes it works out that way. I worked at this photograph. I wouldn't say I didn't work hard at it, but I would like to say, honestly, that I felt like I was fumbling through the shoot. He thought that I was deliberate, but he didn't know the sheer panic that was on the other side of the lens as I was trying to think of good ideas for him to assume positions and poses and looks with his eyes.
Was it like a fake it till you make it kind of scenario?
Absolutely. It's always, you start out in a career 80% bluff, 20% knowledge. And the sooner you can flip those statistics, and now I'm 99% knowledge and 1% bluff.
So we mentioned that you have 2 photographs in this show. The other photograph is of James Earl Jones.
Yes, James Earl Jones was as fantastic as you might imagine. His persona, he was such a professional. I learned a lot from James Earl, and I worked with him for 3 days. He came to Kansas City and flew in, and I was working on an advertising campaign for him. And he was just so genuine and such a gentleman. And I really wanted to do some portraits of him because it had nothing to do with the shoot that I was doing for the commercial job. And I was trying to get up the courage to ask him. And James Earl then pops out. He says, "Nick, I notice you do a lot of great portraiture. Would you mind while I'm here doing some portraits of me?" And of course, I was over the moon over this. I said, "Absolutely, I'd love to." And so we shot maybe only 10 minutes with James Earl. It didn't take a whole lot to get something great from him because he's an actor.
What were you trying to capture?
Well, he was very demonstrative with his hands. And he was such the quintessential professional that I wanted his hands to be in the photograph in an unusual way. And I just kind of kept talking to him, and he kept animating, and I just said, "Keep animating, and I'll keep shooting."
And had your eye on his hands. That's unusual for portraiture, I would say.
Yeah, especially posed like this in that particular photograph.
But yeah, can you describe it?
Well, his hands were kind of up against his chest, almost in an endearing way, as if he's reflecting on his career. But he had a smile on his face because he was remembering good parts. And a lot of times I will ask them, I go, think of some of the very best parts of your career that you've enjoyed. And then that'll put a look on their face. And I'll say, tell me about it. And they'll tell me a little bit about it. And then I go, now let's switch back to some of the parts that you don't care for. And that'll immediately get a serious look on their face. And then I'll try to elevate them again. It's
that's better than saying smile and say cheese or give me a pensive look.
No, I know. That won't be authentic, and it has to be authentic to them. But the very best part of that shoot was I'd invited my wife and two young kids down to the photo shoot, and they weren't going to come. And I said, you got to come. It's James Earl Jones. And they said, well, we're busy. I said, come anyway. So they came. When James Earl saw my kids, he reached his arms out, and they came and sat on his lap, and he talked to them in the Darth Vader voice.
That is a memory to have.
Yeah, both my kids were sitting on James Earl's lap while he was speaking in the Darth Vader voice. I'll never forget that.
How did you get into photography?
I was one of those weird kids that knew what he wanted to do at about age 12. I was just getting ready to turn 13. And my uncle, Mike Mardix, came over and showed his portfolio of black and white images on the kitchen table to my parents. And I just sat there wide-eyed looking at his work. It was all black and white. It was all incredible. And this one particular portrait was so riveting. You could see into the eyes of this, what I thought was a farmer. And that night I announced to the family I wanted to become a professional photographer at age almost 13, and then bought my first camera, which was a 2.25 twin lens, and just put black and white in it and went around the neighborhood shooting pictures all the time.
What neighborhood was this?
I grew up in South Kansas City. I went to Border Star, then Southwest High School. I grew up off of Warnell, kind of in the Brookside area, and my best friend across the street also had a camera, so the two of us would go out on little expeditions in the neighborhood.
Do you have a favorite image that comes to mind when you think of those times capturing images in South Kansas City and Brookside?
Actually, yes. My friend David Haken, we went in his basement and we somehow worked out a stroboscopic effect at age, I think, 15. And I made it look like I was punching him in slow motion. But it had at least 7 or 8 flashes intermittent in there, so it looked like I was hitting him, but I really wasn't. It was faked, and it was a pretty strong accomplishment for age 15 that we had calculated the exposure for a multi-flash segment like that.
What is your philosophy when it comes to capturing someone's image for a portrait?
Oh, wow. Do you have any beer?
We need that for this conversation?
No, we can get along without it. Actually, my philosophy is this. I'm anti-formula. I try not to have a formula. I try to have what I call an interpretive attitude toward people. So if I looked at your face, for instance, I immediately see if your eyes are deep set or if they're normal. Are they wide? Are they big?
I suddenly feel very self-conscious.
As you should. You're under the analysis of it. If you're wearing glasses, I would factor that in. And I started factoring in all of the things about the face. And then I look at wardrobe and what he or she is wearing.
And what are you looking for when you look at the wardrobe? Like, are you looking for what the person is trying to communicate, or are you looking at some sort of like formal line and drape and sort of like aesthetic just components that you're going to arrange into your image?
Those are all aesthetic. What I should do if I do it correctly is talk to them for at least 5 or 10 minutes before I begin, so I begin to understand them. And I also want to know what they do. And then that helps me realize what I'm going to do during the photo shoot.
Well, Nick Vidros, thank you so much, and we'll have to get that beer some other time.
Thank you.
Nick is a local photographer with two images and a big show at the Albrecht Kemper Museum in St. Joe. The show is Portraits Americana, a brief survey of American portrait photography, and it's up till January 6th. Not much time, so hurry and see it. And that's a wrap for today's show on KCUR's Central Standard. If you missed something you really want to hear, that is okay. We archive all our conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. Our talk with the author who recreated Mark Twain's favorite foods will be up by the end of the day, kcur.org/centralstandard. And this chat with Nick Vidros will be there too, kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, space law. Yes, I just said space law. That is a thing now, and we will meet a Kansas City space lawyer. Find out more tomorrow on KCUR's Central Standard. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Suzanne Hogan, Chris Young, and Coy Duggar. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.